Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, sky-high housing prices cause a lot of problems in the Bay Area. One of them is long commutes. Some say high-speed rail could help solve that problem and make Merced and Fresno new bedroom communities for workers in Silicon Valley. But is that likely to happen? We'll take an in-depth look later in our show. We open our program today, though, in Kings County, a place known for farm products like cotton and milk, as well as prisons and the Lemoore Naval Air Station. The rural county is home to only four incorporated cities and dozens of smaller places like Kettleman City on Interstate 5. But as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, one Southern California group wants to build a brand new high-tech town in what some might consider an unlikely place.
Many people who visit Kings County don't even realize they're there. That's because they're zooming by along Interstate 5 from Los Angeles to San Francisco. About halfway, an oasis materializes along the edge of a coastal mountain range. It's here that drivers like Rob Parker from Vancouver stop to stretch their legs.
Our two-year-old boy was bouncing off the walls inside of our motorhome, and I looked out the window and I saw a sign for Kettleman City, and it said, a cool place. So we said, okay, well, that's for us.
The Parkers ended up at a Western-themed rest stop called Bravo Farms that sells produce and knickknacks. Michelle Maguillon, the manager there, is scooping ice cream for a couple visiting from Fresno.
I'll just get the mint chocolate chip.
A single scoop?
Yes.
It's $4.25.
You get people from out of town, out of state, out of the country, people just passing by. You're in the middle of nowhere.
Maguillon says she's heard of rumors of a state-of-the-art city in the works about 8 miles south of here called Quay Valley. I pulled over off I-5 to take a look at the site. At the moment, this proposed town is nothing but 7,500 acres of sagebrush and tumbleweeds on either side of the interstate. But Quay Hayes, the guy behind the project, wants to transform it.
You go under an underpass, and what you'll see, to the right, we would have a very large entertainment destination. On the left, we would have some very unique themed resort hotels. And then you go into the community itself.
The proposed town calls for multiple village centers with stores and restaurants, a mall, and a college with a focus on sustainability and green practices.
Who's the target demo?
People who want a healthier lifestyle, but also people who want to have the latest technology at their fingertips. All the homes will be smart homes, and the buildings will be smart buildings.
Hayes tried to get the project up and running in 2007. But a slump in the economy and a lawsuit over water halted the plan. Now the project is back on the table. He's envisioning a city of 75,000 people with solar-powered homes, a gray water system, and a pod system run by magnets for transportation called a hyperloop.
After the initial testing of moving humans, it could be an intermodal transportation system within Quay Valley. It could connect Quay Valley to different population clusters throughout the state.
Hayes says he would like to see more ideas like the Hyperloop call Quay Valley home. It's all part of his plan to develop a town dedicated to sustainable practices. But for this city to become a reality, his plans will have to get past the Kings County Planning Division led by Greg Gatzka.
I'm very excited about this process, but to build an entire new community when there's nothing that exists there. Very comprehensive in terms of the services, the facilities, the financing, everything that would be necessary to actually support that.
Gatzka's staff is working with Hayes on the early stages of planning before it gets a green light. He says Hayes will have to prove Quay Valley will actually benefit Kings County. Gatzka says there are a number of looming questions yet to be answered, like who is going to fund the project and where will Quay Valley get its water?
Water is going to be a very critical issue and resource. Where is the water going to come from and how are they going to provide it in a sustainable manner to protect those potential future residents that would actually live out there or have businesses out there.
Some of that water will come from water rights Hayes' company purchased for the initial phase, but he isn't sure where the rest will come from. The other issue that people are having over this project is whether building a brand new city is even a sustainable practice. Stephen Wheeler is an environmental design professor at UC Davis.
I am pretty skeptical. If we were really thinking about investing $5 billion or whatever it's going to be, it would be way more sustainable to invest it in Fresno or some existing city.
He would rather see empty lots and abandoned buildings in existing cities get upgrades and hook into already built city grids. Fresno State Urban Planning Professor Hongwei Dong agrees.
It's supposed to be self-sustained, but on the other hand, I assume they are going to rely on people from offside to go shopping there, to go there for entertainment.
He says all those people traveling to Quay Valley could actually increase pollution to an area of the state already plagued with air quality issues.
Adrian, order's ready.
Back in Kettleman City, people like Michelle Magallan, who live and work in the area, think a high-tech town like Quay Valley could boost the economy in Kings County.
It may bring more jobs to the Kettleman City area and other closer locations.
Would you want to live in a place like that?
I probably would. It'd probably keep me healthier and living longer, so why not?
But it'll be at least a couple years before Magallan can move to Quay Valley. Developers would like the first set of homes and attractions ready to live and shop in by 2019. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Election Day is just 2 weeks away. It's not just candidates that are on the ballot. There's also some ballot measures. Some Fresno and Madera County residents may remember Measure E, a bond passed back in 2002 that funded repairs and improvements at community colleges throughout the valley. Now the State Center Community College District is asking for money again on a bigger ballot measure. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports.
The chemistry department at Fresno City College is a model for shrewd, pragmatic use of space. Every inch of stacked shelves, stuffed cabinets, and crucial countertops is in use. Chemistry professor Seth Yates says as more students enroll and safety regulations call for more equipment, the limiting factor here is space.
We're just taking loads of stuff out of here, whatever we can get rid of, all the time, and we still can't find storage space for the stuff that we need.
The school even bought lab stools specially made to be extra narrow, foldable, and stackable.
We're just out of options. There's no way to run a modern lab any other way than we're like pushed to the edges right now. And without doing some major renovations, there's just no way to use the space any better than we have that we can think of at least.
The building has other problems too. Bill Stewart is the interim chancellor of the State Center Community College District, which includes City College and four other schools in the San Joaquin Valley.
We must replace our mass science building on Fresno City College. We have asbestos in the building. It is safe. We have it contained. We have it sealed off, but it has to be replaced.
That's why the district introduced Ballot Measure C. It's a $485 million bond that aims to replace and repair old buildings throughout the district, like portable classrooms in Fresno City College's Police Academy and the Oakhurst campus of Reedley Community College. And the measure isn't just about classrooms. Reedley would get a new performing arts center, and a new garage would help solve Fresno City College's pesky parking problem.
We haven't really sold you a parking permit there. We sold you a hunting permit. I don't know if you've ever been there, but you can't park. And so there's $50 million set aside to solve that problem.
Stewart says improvements like this are essential because of the sheer volume of students that cycles through these community colleges.
We're a very large district. We're as big as the state of Connecticut. We have 1/300th of the people that live in the United States are in our district, and we serve 50,000 students.
Those in favor of Measure C are voting for a property tax. For every $100,000 of property value, taxes would increase by $18.50.
For the average homeowner in our district, it is about $38 a year. That's a Starbucks cup of coffee a month. So it's pennies a day in order to provide this opportunity for our students.
It's true that these schools are important. They're the only educational option many people have here in the Valley, and they're feeder schools for four-year colleges and universities throughout the state. But is a property tax the best way to improve schools? Tal Cloud doesn't think so. He's the political director at the conservative business group, the Lincoln Club of Fresno County.
Well, I think it was hastily put on the ballot without a lot of public comment. The ballot language is very loose and fast. And quite frankly, I think the priorities they've chosen are not positive for the community.
He particularly disagrees with taxpayer money going toward a parking garage. He's right that not all the proposed projects have precise budgets yet, and it's not clear which ones would take priority. He points to 2002's Measure E as a much more transparent community college measure. Plus, he says, factoring in bond interest, Measure C could end up costing much more than $485 million.
The reality is we should find ways to maximize the existing campuses and find ways to move kids through the system. I mean, so many of the community colleges, they have people that are in class that aren't moving forward, and that's what they need to be focusing on.
Measure C will appear on the ballot on June 7th in parts of Fresno, Madera, Kings, and Tulare counties. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Election Day is just 2 weeks away. One of the biggest races in Fresno County is the one for county supervisor in District 5, the seat currently occupied by Debbie Poochigian. Last week, we heard from one of the candidates, current Clovis Mayor Nathan Magsig. Today, we turn our attention to another candidate for that seat, Alexander Ott, who joins us in our studio today. Alex, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Ott is the executive director of the California Apple Commission, the California Blueberry Commission, and the California Blueberry Association, also the California Olive Committee. He owns a company that provides food safety and security management for farmers. Alex, it sounds like you're pretty busy in your day job. Why'd you seek to add to that?
Well, thanks again for having me this morning. And bottom line is I'm a business owner. And what we really need here in Fresno County is someone who understands the business community, someone who understands the impacts if we don't have good jobs and good businesses here. And that's one reason why I'm running. My daughter, who's 14, is getting ready to already starting to look at colleges, and we want to be able to hopefully keep her here in the Valley. And if we don't have those opportunities for her, she won't be coming back. She'll be going to other places where there are other opportunities.
You've expressed some concern about the current direction of the Board of Supervisors. Share those with us right now.
Well, the way I see it is that there's three main issues that are happening in Fresno County. And the first, of course, is water. We need water. Without water, we can't sustain our ag industries. We won't be able to sustain businesses and the way our life is here in Fresno County. So water is critical. Second, of course, is taxes and overregulation. I can't tell you how many friends of mine it's difficult to do business or want to do business in Fresno County. For example, I had a good friend who finished building a building down south of us, and he called up and said, "Hey, I saved $10,000 and 6 months worth of paperwork." "Well, where did you build your property?" "Oh, well, we built it just a half a mile south of Fresno County." That's not a good thing. We need to be able to keep those businesses here and see what we can do to lure them here. And with those businesses, we'll increase on jobs. And then, of course, third is public safety. You have to be able to protect what you have here, and that's, you know, your families, that's your businesses, and your way of life. And so those are the three issues that I see are critical for Fresno County.
I hear a lot of candidates talking about the business-friendly thing, and that's across the board, not just in Fresno County, but the city of Fresno, other races. We're covering races in Kern County and Bakersfield. They say the same thing. These are all pretty conservative areas, and for the most part, the boards, the councils, the jurisdictions we're talking about are generally dominated by Republicans or right-leaning politicians. Why is it that we have these problems if pro-business candidates are actually in office already?
Well, I think we're at a critical time here in California, and I think we're in a critical time here in Fresno County. Your largest industry here in Fresno County is agriculture. And that is a very good base. And with that, with all of the rules and the regulations that are happening at the state level, which is out of the county's control, it has the impacts here on the county. And so how can the county compete with other counties that are facing the same rules and regulations. So for example, one of the things that are on the horizon is we have these increases in regulations, increases in the minimum wage that we're going to see. That's going to have a huge impact here locally, not just on county employees, but also on businesses as well. And what you're going to see in the ag industry more and more is you're going to see a lot more mechanical means of doing things. We're seeing a lot more mechanical harvesting going on. For example, in blueberries, a lot of the folks that you talk to are looking at going to mechanical harvesting. What happens when we do that? Well, if you have four mechanical harvesters and there's only four people on each mechanical harvester, that's only 16 people, where typically you have 350 to 400 people working in the fields right now. So what happens to those jobs? They go away. When those jobs go away, so goes a lot of the revenue that comes with those jobs, which is going to have some impacts here on the local county and so forth. So we need to, in my opinion, take a business side approach to things. Look at how we can streamline things, how we can be more innovative, how we can use technology to our advantage, not just in businesses, but also in county government as well.
Alexander Ott is with us today on Valley Edition. He's running to replace Debbie Puchigian on the Fresno County Board of Supervisors. You've earned Supervisor Puchigian's endorsement and also a sizable contribution as well from her campaign coffers. Tell me what you think about her performance on the board.
I think she's been a great steward of being the watchdog on fiscal conservative principles there, and whoever gets this position, there's some big shoes to fill. I mean, she is, her and her family have done just a phenomenal job here in the Valley, whether it be with her dad, who sat on the supervisor, Darren Collegian, way back when, and then Debbie Puchigian, serving us there. And then, of course, her husband, Chuck Puchigian, who served us in the Assembly and the Senate. It's just been a great family, and I think a very good example of what we need to do to be the watchdog of the people's money, of the taxpayers' money.
Talking about what's already underway at the County Board of Supervisors, one thing that's been a big issue has been water over the last year. Two things really going on that directly are in the parlay of the Board of Supervisors. One is this groundwater sustainability issue. The county is trying to take a lead on that. B, the issue of the spending the money from the water bond and construction new water infrastructure like Temperance Flat. On the groundwater issue, first of all, that is controversial. You have a lot of people on different sides of the issue. In fact, sometimes neighbors disagreeing on this when it comes to the agricultural community. What do you think is the best course of action? Because you represent a lot of these growers. Some of them could be the ones who are being harmed right now by maybe their neighbor pumping down and they're having to put a new well in because they're no longer, they're now above the water table. Others might be ones that could benefit quite a bit from a new approach, but this is still many years in the works. What do you think is the best approach on the groundwater thing from the county perspective?
Sure. Well, I think Mark Twain said it best, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. And in California, it's a great example of what's actually happened. I think what has to happen in terms of water is you have to take an overall comprehensive water approach. And unfortunately, we look for Band-Aid fixes. We look for, if we can get a little something here, that'll benefit us. If we get a little something here, that'll help us. Let's, start with, the overall water issue itself. When you look at the forest, for example, we're already overgrown in the forest areas. Healthy Forest report comes out and says that we're supposed to have 120 to 200 trees to the acre. And right now we're somewhere around 600 trees to the acre. Well, what does that mean? Well, that actually has an impact on the water all the way down into the valley and on the west side. If we can somehow manage those forests and get them healthy, we're able to capture, more of the snowfall. We're able to alleviate a lot of those trees that are sucking some of that water up, and you get additional water that's coming in, from that area that's soaking a lot of it up. That will assist you in groundwater. That'll assist you in storage. And then you, of course, have to look at how we can work with our state and federal reps in order to get additional water storage, whether it be at Temperance Flat, whether it be at some of these groundwater recharging areas. I mean, it's not just a simple, oh, if we do this, we get all the water we want. It has to be a comprehensive, you know, from east to west approach to see, you know, what we can do in the foothills and in the mountains, and what can we do on the west side, and what can we do on the in the central area in order to get as much water as we can.
Water may be one of the biggest needs for this area, but a lot of what the county does is more on the social service side. If you look at the budget, a lot of state money that passes through the county. That's what the Board of Supervisors is in charge of, largely. One of the things that came up, I believe it was last year, maybe a little over 12 months ago, was this issue about health care for undocumented immigrants. Debbie was one of the strongest voices in opposition to the county, or to the effort to bring back the program that provided those funds. Ultimately, the county did, through some one-time money from the state. That money is going to run out, though. If you were elected, what would your position be on that program that provided specialty care for undocumented immigrants in the county?
Well, I think we've seen that, you know, for a while, is these services are not sustainable. And I think, number two, it was for specialty care. The question for healthcare has never been, do people have access to it? It's who pays for it. And in this particular instance, it was specifically for specialty care. I don't believe we should be providing specialty care for undocumented immigrants. I think there are other services out there to assist that, whether it be for nonprofits, whether it be through some of the private companies that specialize in those areas. That's where we should probably be partnering up with, and not have the taxpayers flip the bill, but see what these other nonprofits, where they specialize in those areas, can help out and help with those services. I think it shows that, again, we're trying to be everything to everybody. What we need to do is take, like I say, business approach and sit down and say, what are the priorities of the county? Where is our limited resources best available to see where they can go? And then, more importantly, for those services that we can't provide, where can we turn to some of these other outside organizations and utilize them and utilize what their talents are?
Given that many of those people work in the agriculture industry, if that is the case, in your philosophy, as you just laid out very well, shouldn't agriculture and the industry do more?
We're actually seeing a lot of that already. And if you talk to a lot of the growers that are out there, there are some programs that a lot of growers will provide for the workers. There's a lot of interest. I mean, after all, if you treat your workers well, they come back the following year. And if they if you don't treat them well, you don't have that labor. And so, you know, you see a lot of these types of incentives. You see that in private business all the time. What do you do to keep talent here at your company so you're not constantly having this revolving door? And so I think if you ask, well over a majority of the growers, they want to keep those workers here, and they want to help provide for those workers. Unfortunately, with the rules and the regulations and the taxes and the burdens that continue to be placed on private industry in general, you're seeing more and more people, you know, going to some type of technology means or mechanical means. And unfortunately, we're going to be losing more and more of those jobs.
Speaking of immigration, at the top of the ticket in June is going to be the presidential race. Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, has taken a very strong line on immigration, one that has been criticized by many in the agriculture community here. The farm community depends on a reliable supply of labor, of individuals. Many of them, as we know, are undocumented. What is your position on Donald Trump?
Well, I would say, first of all, we'll start with the position on ag jobs. I think having a comprehensive immigration reform is something that we all support, and in the ag industry, and something that, you know, we need. Folks should come up here, work, and then if they want to go back, they go back. I mean, that's always been the position of ag and having some type of an ag jobs program. In terms of taking a position on the presidential race, I mean, I would just say we got a primary here in a couple of weeks, and the Fresno County Board of Supervisors is a nonpartisan race, so I'm just going to leave it at that.
Would the deportation issue, if
Mr. Trump's proposal were to come to pass and deport 11 million people, would that have a significant impact on the local economy and agriculture employment?
I think we're already starting to see a big impact on labor itself right now. We're seeing a lot of lack of labor out there. Again, even though we're and that's why you're starting to see a huge streamline going into mechanical harvesting, mechanical pruning and so forth because of the lack of labor. And so it's a challenge. I think obviously as this issue cracks down on illegal immigration, unless we have a comprehensive ag jobs bill that can truly assist, you know, growers and truly assist the workers, we're going to be in trouble.
One of the other things the Board of Supervisors is involved with is county planning. There have been some issues that have popped up there recently. There's a lot of new development already on the books, things like Millerton, Newtown, and other areas that are growing new communities in unincorporated areas that will be served by the county. The county gets development dollars there when that happens, so that's good for county coffers. Recently, though, the Board of Supervisors looked at a study for new development in the Fryant area, the unincorporated area just north of the city of Fresno on the river bottom. The board ultimately rejected the privately funded report that looked at development potential in that area, saying it didn't look enough at impacts to ag, impacts to water. But there's still a lot of interest in developing that river bottom in the county. What's your stance on something like that, developing that area and in general county development in unincorporated areas, intensifying development? In many cases, this is Williamson Act land, ag land that's been preserved under contracts and property tax breaks. Should the county get into the development game more in areas like that?
Well, I think former Supervisor Phil Larson said it best, and he's a supporter of mine, and that's show me the water. If you don't have the water, we shouldn't be developing. The city has a lot of those resources. I truly believe in the infill situation to where you should be building infill first. I know the general plan is always you know, being looked at, but unless we have the water, unless we have the resources available, I don't see how one can develop. And two, in terms of ag land, I mean, once you pave over ag land, you can never get it back. And that is one thing that Fresno County has done so well, being the number one ag county in the nation. Is
until recently.
Until recently. Sure.
Kern County, our listeners there are saying, wait, what about us? Tulare as well, yeah.
Number one, number two, number three. We're definitely yeah. The, but what we're seeing, though, is once you pave that over, you don't get it back. And you lose what you know, we're here for, and that is to help feed a nation. And when we start losing that, and we're having to rely on other people to have our food, we're going to be in trouble. I think former Mayor Alan Autry said it best: if you love foreign oil, you'll love foreign food. I think we should probably continue to produce our own.
Before we go, I just want to touch on public safety. The sheriff is an elected position, her own office there, but the Board of Supervisors does control the budget. When it comes to hiring more officers or your approach in general to public safety, it's easy to say we're going to hire more officers. A, I always ask, where's the money going to come from? And B, is that enough? Because you don't control all the criminal justice system. There's also the jail. There's also realignment and all these other things that are going on. What would you do to try to improve that situation in some way?
Well, I'll tell you, the sheriff has done a great job, and especially since 2009 with all of the budget cuts that she received and so forth. And it's been a challenge for her, but she's done a great job with the limited resources that she's had. And it's also, you know, I live in a county island, and so we definitely appreciate and support our sheriff. One of the other aspects that people don't think of with the sheriff is they also do the rescue up in the county mountains and so forth. So they're not just law enforcement. They have a large job description that they have to fill. And I think one of the things that I want to do is I want to go in and I want to sit down with the sheriff as well as all the other department heads and say, okay, what are your priorities? What are we looking at? And very similar to what we do with private business. We have to take a look at our strengths and our weaknesses and analysis and look at where we can hopefully streamline some things and look at where we can hopefully strengthen some things. And if she needs some additional support and resources, that's some of the discussions that you'll want to have with her.
Speaking of streamlining, would you support some sort of consolidation, even if it's back office functions between the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and other agencies?
Like I said, I like my sheriff, and I like what she does for us. And
so even dispatch is off the table.
Well, I think everything is what we can look at. We look at where we can streamline. I think there's always some common sense approaches that we can use, but at the same time, I think she's the expert. Let's see what her priorities are. I think that's the other approach that I take, that I'm very different. You know, I'm a private business owner, and I take a private business aspect of it. I'm not a politician, and I don't look at it as, more government, more government. I think there is definitely ways that we can look outside and see where best to use our limited resources and best utilize our taxpayer dollars.
Alexander Ott is the executive director of the California Apple Commission, the California Blueberry Commission, and if that weren't enough, also the California Olive Committee. He owns a company that provides food safety and security management for farmers. Alexander, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you again.
Stay with us. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition in just a moment and hear about the issues regarding high-speed rail. Will commuters from the Bay Area actually move to the Central Valley if high-speed rail ever becomes a reality? Some people in Silicon Valley say yes, others say not so fast. We'll talk about that and more coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. Supporters of California's ambitious high-speed rail project are making a lot of big promises about what the line can achieve. Everything from less greenhouse gas emissions to fewer cars on the road. One of the most far-reaching claims is the potential to revolutionize towns where the stations will be, like Fresno and Merced. As part of a two-part series on the train and long-haul commuters, Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess examines if the Central Valley will one day be the bedroom community for Silicon Valley.
The list of potential benefits from completing the high-speed rail project that advocates roll out is almost as long as the rail itself. High on that list is turning the Central Valley into the new home for thousands of workers who've been displaced by sky-high housing prices in the Bay Area.
We're going to be able to shrink the globe quite literally by linking Fresno and San Jose.
Carl Gardino is the CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. That's a collection of tech companies that advocate on issues such as transportation, and in this case are strongly in favor of the bullet train. In his view, the train is going to provide relief for a Bay Area housing market that has spiraled out of control and help thousands of middle-income workers find a home in the Central Valley.
Try to be a teacher or a police officer or a firefighter or somebody who works in retail or a restaurant. It is nigh impossible to live anywhere near the jobs that we're producing in abundance here.
The median home price in San Jose, according to industry research, is four times that of the rest of the country, reaching nearly $900,000. Prices have doubled since 2000, making the region one of the most expensive places to live in the country. As Silicon Valley took off, many middle-class workers fled to the North Valley, transforming once tiny farming communities like Los Banos into sprawling bedroom communities with more affordable housing. The median home price there is less than $250,000. The result is thousands of people are now commuting very long distances to find work, sometimes 2 hours or more. Gardino sees them trading in their daily car commute for a predictable 1 hour on the train in exchange for cheaper housing in the Central Valley. University of the Pacific researcher Jeffrey Michael says more than half of all the workers in Los Banos commute, and of that, about 40% are commuting over the hill into the bay, a commute that for most takes more than 90 minutes each way. However, Michael is highly skeptical of Gardino's prediction that thousands will be making the commute every day from one valley to the other and back on the high-speed rail.
You know, unless there was a huge revolution in their plan for financing it, I don't see the ability to subsidize it enough to really make it cost-effective for daily commuting use.
Riding the rail won't be cheap. Doing rough math based on fare tables released by the High Speed Rail Authority, it could cost north of $2,000 a month to commute on the train each way 5 days a week. Gardino counters that package rates would likely bring that cost down. Also, that simply looking at dollar figures ignores the lost hours, wear and tear on cars, and non-economic costs like missing family time that mega commuters are currently paying. However, not even all high-speed rail supporters agree with Gardino, including Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen. She thinks companies will move operations to Fresno, so CEOs can easily pop in and out, or have workers commute less frequently, rather than a large influx and outflow of daily commuters.
I think that's unrealistic. I don't think we're looking at, you know, I live in Fresno, but I go to work every day in the Silicon Valley. I think we actually see jobs imported from the Silicon Valley to Fresno.
The High-Speed Rail Authority seems to be somewhere in between Mayor Swearingen and Mr. Gardino. Authority Vice Chair Tom Richards is somewhat skeptical of the scale of the commuters, but acknowledges many people are already making long commutes in search of lower home prices, and that some may be willing to call Fresno or Merced home.
Well, there's certainly some body of information that would suggest that the housing markets in the Central Valley will provide some relief for the difficulty in terms of affordability of buying houses up in the Silicon Valley and the Bay Area.
There's a big financial reason why people could consider the high-speed rail to be a better option than the drive. The rent tracking website rentjungle.com says the average rent for a two-bedroom apartment in San Jose is just shy of $2,800 a month. In Fresno, it's $850. That's sure to climb if Fresno becomes a hot destination, but would still be far cheaper than Silicon Valley. The bottom line is housing stock just hasn't been able to keep up, leading to an effect like squeezing a balloon. The air has to go somewhere. That somewhere was into towns in the North Central Valley that have boomed in population and have also transformed communities and created the new class of supercommuters. We'll meet one and learn what it's like to go on a mega commute and what it means for those communities next week. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
And Jeffrey joins us now in our studio to talk a little more about this issue. Jeffrey, we already have people making these commutes. You mentioned in the North Central Valley, Los Banos, Tracy, even Modesto have a lot of people who are making these drives. Who are these people?
Well, it's really remarkable. When I approached this, I thought it was going to be mostly high-value tech workers, people who are making a lot of money. But what it turns out the research shows is that it's really a lot of middle-class people who have just been really forced out by the just insane rates of housing that are growing in San Jose and Silicon Valley in that area. So it's people who are office workers, it's government functionaries, it's cops, it's firefighters, it's school teachers. It's people who are required to make the function of any big city like that area is work. And they're making an economic decision, one that they've decided, it makes more sense for me to commute 90 minutes, 2 hours each way, which you're now working 12-hour days, you work an 8-hour shift, that it is to try and afford the mortgage on a home in the Bay Area.
So what are these commutes like? Not to steal the thunder of your next piece where you're actually going to take us on one of these, but these are not just easy drives.
No, this is not an easy drive at all. And I went on a ride with one person who was very helpful to me, but I interviewed 6 or 8 other people who make this drive, and they listed so many things. One guy was 35 years old, already had back and hip problems from working the mechanics of the car, had ruined his hip. Every day I'm part of a Facebook group for these commuters. Every day they're always posting. There's usually a wreck. It's very windy over the pass, so that's the dangerous part. People really like to move. They get late to work, and so they have to scoot, and their people are just flying. I mean, we were going the speed limit and just getting passed a lot. A lot of it's two-lane roads, winding roads. Something I don't know if we'll be able to get into, but a woman I talked to said, you know, I really want you to think about what she called the 152 widows, which are the wives and families of typically men who have been killed while they're trying to make that pass. The guy I rode with actually wouldn't even say the word accident while we were doing it, and he alluded to what I assume he's probably seen fatal wrecks. And so there's a lot of dollars and cents gets talked about when the high-speed rail gets rolled out there. They talk about how much it's going to cost. Will people ride it? What are they going to do when they get to the Bay Area without a car? But there's also a whole lot of non-economic costs, lost family times. I talked with one teacher in Los Banos who said one day she looked down at her phone and realized all of her emergency contacts were 408 numbers for the Bay Area as opposed to their area code there. So it's really quite a fascinating mixture of what's going on with the people who are making that commute and how they might not necessarily see themselves as positioned to be the prime high-speed rail rider.
I want to expand the conversation now with two guests who join us in our studio today. Elizabeth Johnson is with the California High-Speed Rail Authority, and also Leanne Eager, who is president and CEO of the Fresno County Economic Development Corporation. Elizabeth, I want to start with you. Has high-speed rail been envisioned as, we're talking about commuters today, has it really been envisioned as a commuter service? So much of what we're talking about is going L.A. to San Francisco or Fresno to L.A. Sounds like more of a long-haul thing. Is the commuter idea an important part of the high-speed rail business plan?
So it's really important to look at this a little holistically in terms of high-speed rail. There is a sweet spot that high-speed rail research shows where high-speed rail fits in as to being the most efficient mode of transportation. So between zero or 1 miles and 200 miles, the trip, most people will choose to take their automobile. And after 500 miles, they would choose to fly. So between that 200 and 500 miles is really where high-speed rail has found their sweet spot. So for the most part, that rules out commuters. However, there will certainly be people that would choose, because of the efficiency and because of all those other factors, health and time and other considerations, to use high-speed rail.
So when we're talking about high-speed rail fares, obviously it's a long time before someone can actually purchase a ticket. So these are just estimates at this point. But are we talking about fares that are competitive with a subway ticket or an airplane ticket or somewhere in between? What are we looking at there?
So for our business plan, we basically based it off automobile and plane tickets. So, for example, looking at our business plan, if we were to go from Fresno to, say, Orange County, we're looking at about, from Fresno to Orange County, $89, but maybe from San Jose to Kings Tulare, $68 a ticket. So it is, of course, for one person, probably a little more than taking your car. However, there are those other considerations.
Jeffrey, it's not cheap. These people who are doing this drive already from either Los Banos or Tracy or Modesto, there's a significant expense associated with that, not just in gas.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's wear and tear on your car. The guy I went with, who I keep referencing, he got one of his Toyota Corollas got up to 800,000 miles. Which I can't even wrap my mind around. He had since replaced it 2 years ago, and that has 250,000 miles on it. Like, I can't even wrap my mind around that. And one of the things you have to think about when you're making this commute is the time you're just in your car is lost productivity time. You could be making more money if you didn't have to commute so far. I keep coming back to the family issue. We left at 5:30 in the morning. And didn't get back till almost 6 o'clock. I mean, that's before your kids get up. That's after they get home from school, and maybe you have an hour and a half with your family that you'd lost by having to make that commute.
So maybe the biggest backer out there right now who's talking about this as a real important issue is Carl Gardino, who is in your piece. You talked to
him. Very persuasive.
He's head of the Silicon Valley Working Group, a coalition of all these big companies, Adobe, Apple, you name it. They're represented by Carl. And he's saying this is really an option. Does he realistically think that that an Apple employee or a Google employee, a high-value worker, is going to be this sort of commuter, or is he also seeing this as part of that bigger picture?
I think he's seeing it as part of a bigger picture. For him, the high-value Apple workers can afford the rates that are going on in the Bay. And I think for Carl, his point of view is that these people who have just moved just a little bit over the hill into Los Banos, where there's all these unpredictable factors to your commute, they might be the ones who want to trade it in for a very predictable train ticket. So I think he's obviously very much in favor of this, and he's making a persuasive case that this is something that a lot of people are going to want to do. But from talking with him, it seems like he's aware that there are still going to be people who, despite all the incentives that might push them towards commuting by rail, are still going to want to keep their car. I mean, people still really like to drive. You have control. If you have to leave from work to do anything, you know exactly when and where you can go. When you're in the Bay, you're not stuck at the mercy of the train schedule. So I think he is aware that there are going to be people who are still going to decide that it's better to drive 2 hours from Los Banos than it would be to ride the train 45 minutes or an hour from Fresno or Merced.
This maybe is a question that's better posed to Carl and not you, but is there any discussion or inkling of a thought that maybe companies might try to incentivize this as a way to keep their employees happier, healthier, and in some way, you know, not stuck behind the wheel, white-knuckled on the steering wheel as they're going through Pacheco Pass?
Yeah, stressed out on the way home,
yeah,
to and from.
Is that something maybe, Elizabeth, that the High Speed Rail Authority would be interested in working with those companies in some way?
Absolutely, and those are considerations that have definitely been thought of. So this system will be privately operated. So it'll be, in the end, the private operator that finally determines the different fares and the different incentive packages. But I think that employer discounts or, you know, being able to have a pass or all those things will be part of the mixture somehow, because there is that demand and there are those quality of life issues that that have come up and will continue to be part of the discussion.
Well, and it could be an interesting situation. I've been thinking about this quite a bit with these long commutes, where companies start rolling your commute price into like a benefits package, which is, we acknowledge that for you to do your job, it's now taking you an hour commute, a 2 hour commute. We're going to start compensating you in some way. And one way to do that could be by paying the rail fare or paying a portion of the rail fare.
Leanne Eager, who is also with us today, has really been busy on a lot of economic development things related to the heavy maintenance facility. Leanne, is this issue, though, the commuter angle, trying to make Fresno County a destination for people who rely on the high-speed rail as transportation to work, is that something that's been on your radar and the county's radar?
Absolutely. And we've been working on this, just so you know, about 7 years preparing for this, and not just about the maintenance facility, but about the project in general and what that will mean for Fresno County. What we're looking at is the connectivity between Fresno and now the Bay Area, and certainly later on Los Angeles area. That's going to change the economy of Fresno County forever. I was just in San Francisco, I think about 3 weeks ago, and I was talking to the Bay Area Council and the Silicon Valley Group about what does that mean. And they're looking at there in the Bay Area putting out this event that's going to be a super region, right? Because it used to be, you know, if you live in San Francisco, all the companies work together to see how they can make that better. And as that grows and grows and grows, because they've outgrown the Bay Area, they've outgrown Silicon Valley, how do they bring in other regions? Well, we went and talked about Fresno County and the Fresno region should be part of that super region, especially now with high-speed rail. And it's not just, and I think you're right, it's not just about commuting from here to there, because with the tech industry now, it doesn't make any difference where you're sitting, right? You can still be part of that community there, but sit here in Fresno County. And if we're looking at building up our tech industry here and connecting those to what's going on in the Bay Area, this is the perfect place to do that. And then if you do need to go to a meeting, you know, once a week or once a month, you can get on that train and get there in an hour and come back and do your work here. And I agree with the mayor in that we're not just looking at how do we have people live here and commute there because this is a less expensive place to live. We're really pitching that if you want to expand your company and you cannot expand in the Bay Area, you've run out of room, you've run out of money, that those expansions should happen here. And that connectivity with high-speed rail will make that much easier.
Do you have any estimate on what potential boon to the economy high-speed rail could be if it works as envisioned? Again, we're sidestepping all the other debates and controversies,
sure,
and timelines and potential delays or actual delays. But let's just step that aside. What type of potential economic benefit are we looking at?
Well, we're talking billions. You know, right now, just, you know, this system has just started, right? And we're putting people to work here right now, and not just working on the system, but all the ancillary jobs that come with that. You know, there's already $3 billion worth of money coming in to our community right now. Once we start looking outside of building the system, once we start looking at outside of bringing new companies here that want to be around the first high-speed rail in the United States, I think it's endless. I just got back from Germany 10 days ago, and I was at the Hanover Messe Manufacturing Trade Show, largest trade show in the world. Right? This was the first year the United States was the partnering country. So the President of the United States was there, Angela Merkel was there. I had so many people from around the world come and talk to me at my booth about high-speed rail and what are some of the opportunities that they have if they move their company here. So I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg here. We've been preparing for this for a long time. We're ready for those companies that want to come here, that want to work in the city that has the first high-speed rail in the United States, and we're getting ready for it.
Do you think the shift to the northern route first is good for Fresno County?
Well, I hate to leave Los Angeles out because certainly the folks in Palmdale and the folks in Burbank and the folks in Los Angeles, we've been working with them for a long time on how we can continue that. But I think this initial section, first of all, so that we can get people on those trains, because I think that's going to be the most important thing right now is what's the fastest way to get people on those trains. But we really have been working with folks in the Bay Area for a long time about how do we make that connection. I had talked to a CEO of a biotech company in Marin County about 6 years ago. And he said, you know, I'm running out of space here, but I don't manufacture here. And I was like, oh, where do you manufacture your product? And he said, in the Midwest. And I said, why aren't you manufacturing in the Central Valley? I know it's too expensive to manufacture in Marin County, but why aren't you manufacturing in the Central Valley? And he said, it's easier for me to get from San Francisco to the Midwest than it is to get from San Francisco to Fresno. I got to get in my car and drive there. So I said, if high-speed rail comes and connects us, will that change that? And he said, it's a whole new ball game. If I can get to you in an hour, that's a whole new ball game. So we're looking at that too. How do we get those manufacturers here first? It might not be the R&D right away, and we're certainly working on that for the future with UC Merced and Fresno State on how do we get that workforce ready for that. But if we can get that manufacturing here first, game changer.
Elizabeth, one of the things that changed in the most recent business plan, one of the maybe the quietest changes that I think is significant, we've talked about Merced and Fresno today, but the city of Madera is also now on the map in a different way, and that it's going to get a stop on the line. Tell me more about that. And is that a permanent stop, or is that just a temporary way to connect with the Amtrak San Joaquin? How does that work, and how do you manage to still be high speed when you're stopping Fresno, Madera, Merced? Those are all pretty close when you're going fast.
So not every train is intended to stop at every station. To answer your first question, yes, that stop in Madera is intended to be a permanent stop to connect specifically with some of the other passenger rail service, Amtrak specifically, and be able to reach more people in more places. So essentially, someone will be able to get on a train in Sacramento, stop in Madera, connect to high-speed rail, or from LA, connect Madera, and maybe get to another place not serviced by high-speed rail. So it's intended to be a really logical connection to other destinations and other places not being served by high-speed rail. So it is very, very, I would say, exciting for the Valley to have a stop in Madera because, one, Madera is excited about this, and two, just have the ability to have another place in the Valley where there's going to be that investment and that opportunity for more people to be able to connect to the system and be able to take advantage of the ability to be more connected and go to other places. So now essentially we'll have a station in Merced, we'll have a station in Kings County, we'll have a station in Fresno County and Kern County.
Leanne, we just have about 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to add, it really is exciting for the city of Madera. And what this does for them, that gives them an opportunity. If people are getting off there, how can they get to downtown? What kinds of things can Madera do now to really capitalize on this opportunity they were given?
Leanne Eager is the president and CEO of the Fresno County Economic Development Corporation. Also with us today, Elizabeth Johnson, the Public Information Officer for California High-Speed Rail Authority, and Valley Public Radio's own Jeffrey Hess. Tune in next week. We'll find out what it's like to be a mega commuter living in Los Banos and commuting to the Bay. That's coming up on our next Valley Edition. Thanks to all of you for joining us today on Valley Edition. You can find our audio archives and our podcast online at kvpr.org. You can also send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, and tweet us at kvpr and at Valley Edition. For reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.